are Locked On Timberwolves, your daily Minnesota Timberwolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. My name is Ben Beacon. I'm the host of Locked On Wolves. Happy Monday, everybody. Today, we're going to recap the All-Star weekend. We'll start with Josh Okogie's appearance in Friday night's Rising Stars Challenge. We'll also talk through the packed All-Star Saturday and also the newly formatted main event on Sunday evening with the All-Star game itself with a completely new format and a way of keeping score and way to determine a winner. If you missed the game, I know that probably sounds really weird, but I think all things considered, it turned out really well. Before that, though, I do want to talk about general Wolves notes. We take a look at a couple of the pieces of news from the weekend related to the Timberwolves. And before we get to that, I did want to remind everybody to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On T-Wolves. That's at Locked On T-Wolves. Don't forget the T. Okay, the quickest and probably most important piece of news is related to Karl-Anthony Towns' wrist injury. You'll recall that Karl-Anthony Towns missed the final game before the All-Star break on the last Wednesday against Charlotte, somewhat unexpectedly with a wrist injury. He was on the bench, had some sort of a wrist or wrap on his left wrist, but was obviously active on the bench, celebrating with his teammates in the game, all that stuff. And the Wolves, interestingly, they issued a press release on Wednesday afternoon saying he wouldn't play with the wrist injury, that he had an MRI, he would be further evaluated during the All-Star break, but it didn't specify what the injury was. The Wolves still haven't done that. They haven't given an update as of yet. Of course, they haven't needed to over the past 5 days or so. But John Krasinski from The Athletic is now reporting. He reported over the weekend, I guess it was last Thursday, he said, quote, exactly how long Towns will be out with a left wrist injury remains unknown, but it is expected that he will miss multiple games when the Wolves resume playing after the break next week, which of course is this week now. So it doesn't sound like they're expecting Towns to be ready to play as soon as this coming Saturday against Boston, which would mean that that's at least a 9-day absence for Towns. Krasinski also says later in the article that that Towns has been, quote, dealing with pain in his wrist for the last few weeks, but with no discernible improvement, he went in for further testing. And then later on, he also mentions that at this point, the Wolves are not expecting that Towns is going to need surgery for the injury. He says there's, quote, no sense that surgery will be needed to address the issue. Who knows? We don't know. It was mentioned as on the injury report. He was mentioned with a wrist injury earlier in the season, some inflammation. He had fallen on it at one point. Remember there was the game against the Thunder in January when he fell on it and it almost looked like he popped it back into place on the court. So whatever's going on with his wrist, it could be just irritated soreness, something that surgery wouldn't necessarily fix anyways. And so there's no reason to push him. If it could get injured worse, let him sit out for a couple of weeks and then hopefully play the last 20 games or so and get a sense for what the chemistry is going to look like with D'Angelo Russell, Karl-Anthony Towns, and the rest of the team. They've only played one game together, of course, with Russell missing his first game when he was on the Wolves roster, and they both played in the second game, and then Towns missing. That was that loss in Toronto, and then Towns missing the Wednesday loss in Charlotte. So we will see how quickly he gets back, but it's not a good sign. Obviously, during the week, it's possible to get an update. The Wolves return to practice on Wednesday night, it sounds like. So we'll keep an eye on that and definitely talk about it here as well. Also, should mention that Evan Turner, who was acquired in the four-team deal that included the Hawks, Nuggets, and Rockets, I guess a week and a half ago now, the trade that happened before the D'Angelo Russell trade. Turner initially was issued a number by the Timberwolves. It kind of sounded like he might play for a little bit and then potentially get bought out. Then he did not come to the press conference. And now it's looking like he's for sure going to get bought out. And the Wolves actually have some incentive for doing so. The report that came out related to Turner over the past couple of days is that he'll be working out with the LA Clippers. Chris Haynes from Yahoo Sports reported that he's going to work out for the Clippers this weekend, or he did this weekend already. And I mean, it makes sense. There's really no reason for the Wolves to have him on the floor. And the incentive for them to cut him is that they could also save some money. Remember, he's an expiring contract, but he's $18.6 million. And the Wolves are actually slightly in the luxury tax right now. So interestingly, John Hollinger, who now actually, of course, hosts one of the podcasts here on this network and writes for The Athletic, noted that he can't remember there ever being an instance where a player is technically under contract with a team but working out for another one. But he mentions that the Wolves could save quite a bit in the luxury tax because they are, I think, 1.1 or 1.2 million over. And if they can get under by buying Turner out and coming to an agreement where they're not going to pay him the full 18.6 million that he's owed, then the Wolves are definitely going to save some cash there. So interesting choice to let him do that, and probably just very smart by the Wolves. The last thing I wanted to note, Wolves notes-wise, is related to Kevin Garnett. I'm sure everybody saw on Thursday of last week. I don't believe we mentioned it in Friday's episode, but the Boston Celtics announced that they will retire Kevin Garnett's number 5 jersey at some point during next season, during the 2020-2021 season. And, I mean, it was not a shock. Obviously, it's something that, you know, probably should have happened, but I think as a Timberwolves fan, it was a little bit sad to see that be announced before the Wolves and Garnett can come to an agreement on him getting his number 21 jersey retired with the Wolves. And then on Friday, it was announced that Garnett's a finalist, as expected, for this year's Hall of Fame class, which will be announced in early April. Of course, the other headliners are Kobe Bryant and Tim Duncan, but there's several big names in that class, and the fact that Garnett, the two big pieces of news in about 24 hours that didn't really have any positive implications for the Wolves. And the only thing that Garnett said related to the Wolves, he made a comment in a Boston Globe article on Saturday. The quote was, listen, I had some great years in Mini, but when it comes to management, it's not even close. Mini, they ran their team one way. Boston has a culture of basketball. They run it a whole other way, and I respect that. Of course, The Wolves will retire Kevin Garnett's jersey. It had been reported in the local media, and I can't remember who it was exactly, but at times over the past couple of years that the invitation is open and Garnett just needs to say yes in order to get his jersey retired. Garnett is making it sound like it's that the reverse is true, that perhaps Glenn Taylor's pride is getting in the way of them retiring Garnett's jersey. But you could also take Garnett's comment as, because of the way the Wolves are running it, Garnett hasn't accepted the invitation. I can't see any reason why the Wolves, unless Glenn Taylor really is that spiteful related to the Garnett relationship, that he is refusing to retire Garnett's jersey. But there's really no downside from the Wolves' perspective. Obviously, it'd be good PR. It'd be a good thing. And clearly, Kevin Garnett and Ryan Saunders have a good relationship. There's no reason to think he would have any relationship at all with Gerson Rosas, the new front office regime. And Garnett and Towns are still friends. They still talk regularly. Garnett's talked about that before in the media. So clearly, this is just a situation where Glenn Taylor and Kevin Garnett still are not seeing eye to eye, and they don't appear to be close. And I'm sure Garnett's just waiting for Taylor to move on to sell the team, to not be the owner anymore, before he comes back and gets his jersey retired. It just doesn't feel right for somebody who spent the majority of their career in Minnesota and easily, not even close, is the best player in Timberwolves history to get his number in the rafters at another arena before the Timberwolves. But that's where we're at, and unfortunately, that's what we'll be seeing next year. Garnett will almost assuredly be inducted into the Hall of Fame in early April, so that'll be interesting. Hopefully, his comments there are positive, and that should be enjoyable. It'll be good to see him going in such a. He'll be overshadowed a little bit, of course, by Kobe and Tim Duncan, who are two of the few players who are generally consensus. The consensus is that they had better careers than Garnett, or were better players, but at the same time, Garnett's still probably a top 25 player of all time. So it's just a stacked Hall of Fame class. It'll be a lot of fun to see that happen in early April. All right. Next up, we're going to talk about All-Star Friday, and then we'll talk All-Star Saturday and Sunday here over our next couple of segments. All right. I'll start our All-Star weekend recap by acknowledging that I got all of my predictions wrong over the weekend. I started on Friday by predicting that Team World would win the Rising Stars Challenge. At the time, I didn't realize that they were actually 6-point underdogs in the actual line. And Team World was winning big early. I think they were up by like 15 or something at some point. But Team USA had a huge second half. They were actually, Team World was up 10 at halftime. And then Team USA surged in the second half and actually ended up winning by 20. So they outscored the World by 30 points just in the second half, 44-24 margin in the third quarter. Josh Okogie, of course, came off the bench in this game last year in the game as a rookie. He had 13 points for Team World, of course, representing Nigeria, and had a big dunk on the baseline. This year, Okogie only had 5 points off the bench in 16 minutes, did all of his scoring in the first half. He came in the game and hit a three-pointer almost immediately, shot 2 of 5 overall from the field, also had an offensive rebound and a putback. He was 1 of 4 from three-point range. So besides the putback, he just launched 4 threes. At one point, he kind of came around the paint and clearly was planning to throw the ball off the glass and to himself and dunk it, but ultimately turned the ball over instead and didn't get another chance to dunk. He did have 5 assists and 3 rebounds, committed 5 turnovers. Turnovers, of course, are extremely common in this game. In the second half, Okogie did have an impressive block. I can't remember who he blocked, but he pressed up on defense and blocked a fadeaway jumper, sprinted down the court on the fast break, and attempted a three-pointer that almost went down, rimmed out, and then I think it was Luka Doncic got the rebound and dunked it to make it, I think it was like an 8-point game or something at the time. So overall, Okogie had an okay game, but in essentially in the game, there was basically line changes for both teams. The Team World starting lineup, 4 of the 5 starters had a +8 in a +/- column in a game that they lost by 20. So the 4 of the 5 bench players for Team World had -28 marks, and that included Josh Okogie. So -28 for Josh Okogie in this game. But overall, it's just a case of the Team USA just having too much firepower. Trae Young was awesome. Luka Doncic did have a super memorable shot right before halftime where with about 8 seconds left, he slowly dribbled the ball up the court, waited until there were 2 seconds left, and intentionally launched from beyond the half-court line and banked it in. Trae Young had a moment similar to that as well. I guess it was in the actual All-Star game on Sunday. Trae Young hit a half-court shot as well. So both of the young second year guys who were traded for each other on draft night in summer of 2018 did what they were supposed to do and put on a show. Definitely. Miles Bridges won the MVP in the Rising Stars game. He had 20 points and 8 of 12, shooting 5 rebounds, 5 assists, 3 steals, somehow only turned it over one time. He had one really big dunk and then a couple of nice 3-pointers. I think it was third quarter, kind of early in the second half, was a +33 on the night. Eric Paschal from the Warriors also had a game high 23 points on 10 of 13 shooting. A lot of close in shooting there. Colin Sexton had 21 points, of course, of the Cleveland Cavs. But they were edged out by Bridges for the MVP award. Zion Williamson also memorably damaged the rim late in the first half. It looked like it was just a little bit off kilter there. But a really impressive performance overall from Zion Williamson. Trae Young was the only guy who dribbled between somebody's legs. The soccer term nutmeg, of course. That was early in the game. He dribbled between the defender's legs and got to the rim and scored. And then, of course, I mentioned the Doncic shot already. So entertaining game overall. I wish it had been a little bit closer. There actually weren't all that many amazing dunks. At the end of the game, when everybody kind of clears out and lets everybody dunk, there were a lot of misses, and that was a little bit disappointing. But overall, fun game to watch for sure. All-Star Saturday was a lot of fun per always. I had selected in the skills challenge. My prediction was Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It was Spencer Dinwiddie with Gilgeous-Alexander as a runner-up. Dinwiddie was beaten in the first round by Bam Adebayo, who ultimately ended up winning this game. I think Gilgeous-Alexander lost in the first round as well. Adebayo ended up winning the championship, beat Domantas Sabonis in the final round. It was pretty intense. It came down to the final shot with both of them trying to make the three-pointer to win, and Adebayo ultimately prevailed in that one. Three-point contest, I had picked Davis Bertans to win, and I think my runner-up was Joe Harris. Harris didn't make it out of the first round. Bertans did make the finals, so it was Bertans, Booker, and Buddy Hield in the finals. It was really early in the first round, the first couple of scores were the lowest scores. Devontae Graham and Duncan Robinson, I think, had the two lowest scores. And then it got really intense, came down to it, and there was a 26 and a couple 27s were the scores that were needed to get to the finals. And then it literally came down to the last shot. Heald was down by a point to Booker, and it made the last money ball to win by a point. So that was extremely intense. I don't know if that's happened before, but was a ton of fun to watch. And really, like, Zach LaVine had a good performance. Trae Young was good. It just, there was so much solid shooting. Joe Harris had won last year, of course, and couldn't get out of the first round, even though he shot the ball okay. And 2 years ago, Booker won. And so he was in the finals in this one as well. So that was a ton of fun to see. Heald was the first Sacramento Kings player to win since Peja Stojakovic went back to back. I think it was 02 and 03. So a lot of fun. Slam dunk competition. That one was really good. I think it's obvious. It's clear to say that besides the Aaron Gordon, Zach LaVine dunk off in, I think it was 2016, this is the best dunk contest probably in terms of overall level of competition. This one and the Gordon LaVine one, probably going back to 1988 between Dominique and Michael Jordan, which of course was also in Chicago, as we were reminded many times during the broadcast. Derek Jones Jr. beat Aaron Gordon in a dunk off in this game. There was, you know, as always happens, if you go back and look at all the dunks, the scoring early on is a little bit questionable. I think Dwight Howard got a 47 or 48 on some dunks that were not quite as good as some of the ones near the end that didn't score as high. Pat Connaughton got ripped off on one of his dunks and got like a 47 or 46 on a dunk that probably should have been a 49 or a 50. And so the final round, he did end up, Connaughton got a 50 on his second dunk in the first round. And so Dwight was kind of a distant fourth. Connaughton got beat by a couple points by Derek Jones Jr. to go to the finals. So it was between Gordon and Derek Jones. My pick was Aaron Gordon to win this, of course. And the two went head to head. Derek Jones had probably the best couple of dunks, but Gordon got 50s on every single dunk of the night until the very end, when he got inexplicably got a 47 on a dunk that was at least a 49, if not a 50. And there, of course, was some chatter afterwards that the judges had tried to, I guess, agree to make this a tie, because they were so differently than the Gordon LaVine face-off in 16, when they basically just dunked until somebody didn't get a 50. The plan this year was to have two dunks beyond. So the finals are two dunks and then two additional dunks to try and break the tie. And if it's not broken, I believe they were supposed to share the trophy is what it sounded like they were saying on the broadcast. But ultimately, the judges, after giving a 48 to Derek Jones Jr.'s last dunk, it looked like Gordon was about to win it after a monster dunk to get what should have probably been a 50. The judges looked like they were going to agree to give him a 48. And then I guess the working theory is that Dwayne Wade went off script and gave him a 9 as well. Which brought the score down to a 47, which meant that Derek Jones won the dunk contest. And so poor Derek Jones, of course, is now hearing the rumor that Dwayne, it's the fix is in from Dwayne Wade, of course, of the Miami Heat, to help a Miami Heat player in Derek Jones Jr. win the Slam Dunk Championship. Of course, we won't know exactly if that's what happened, but it seems to make some sense, as the other judges looked pretty confused and disappointed. Instead of ending up with a tie, Derek Jones wins the dunk contest. At least there is a winner. He did probably have a couple of the best dunks of the night, and it was certainly close. It's just, it didn't really feel like that was the way it should have gone down after Gordon really did well in the dunk off portion as well. So Derek Jones Jr. wins. My guy got the runner up. I also had one of the finalists pick correctly in the 3-point contest. So I guess my picks weren't all terrible, but I didn't get any right. So here to confess to that. All right, last segment, we're going to talk about the All-Star Game on Sunday and whether or not, talk through the process of the new scoring system related to the game on Sunday. The headline for Sunday's All-Star Game was that the scoring would be completely unconventional. Of course, the common criticism of past All-Star Games is that the teams don't play any defense. It doesn't matter until the last couple of minutes. And if it's not a close game at that point, then it never matters and nobody plays hard. That was absolutely still the case for the first three quarters of this game, even though there was an element, there is a reason to play hard. So the new format was each team would, they're essentially each quarter of the first three quarters is a mini game. The team that wins each quarter gets earns $100,000 to their selected charity. So Team LeBron had a charity called Chicago Scholars. Team Giannis was playing for After School Matters. So each quarter is worth $100,000 of the first three. And then the team that wins the game gets $200,000. The way you win the game is after the score resets for each of the first three quarters, but then after those three quarters, they take the aggregate score and go into the fourth. So in this case, it was 133 to 124 in favor of Team Giannis. And so the scoring then this year, they picked the number 24, which I believe was a nod to Kobe Bryant. So they took 24 and added it to the team that was ahead. So in this case, 157 was the target score for the fourth quarter. So both teams then try to achieve that 157. Obviously, Team Giannis was 9 points closer. So LeBron's team had to score 33 points to get there. And Giannis's team only needed to score 24. But that not having a clock makes things, of course, a little bit more competitive in the fourth quarter. And so then both teams trying to reach the target score. The winning team then gets $200,000 to donate to their charity of choice. And so it did make the fourth quarter a lot more interesting. I mean, there were some actual strategic timeouts. There was some hard defense being played. Kyle Lowry took a charge, I think the first charge ever recorded in All-Star game history, at least that anybody remembers. James Harden tried to hit a step back three that would have won the game, but was called for a push off. And LeBron's team rallied. And then at the end, Kyle Lowry committed a foul. And that allowed Anthony Davis to go to the free throw line. And it was a competitive foul trying to keep, you know, obviously the game was about to be iced. It was 156-155 and LeBron's team just needed to score a basket. So Lowry fouled Davis. Davis actually missed the first free throw and then made the second one to win the game 157-155. So it absolutely made at least the fourth quarter more competitive. Team LeBron won the first quarter pretty easily. Team Giannis won the second quarter even easier. And things were still extremely open. At times, it felt like too open, where teams were actually cherry picking and basically getting layups. It wasn't even fun alley-oops or anything like that. There, of course, were plenty of three-pointers launched. And both teams were playing exactly like it was an All-Star game, probably until the fourth quarter. So I guess it was a little bit of the best of both worlds. If people like the exhibition style and like the more three-pointers, more dunks, more alley-oops, they got all that. And then they also got the competition at the end with both teams playing hard and trying to achieve that target score of 157. I haven't really spent a lot of time finding different opinions on this, but my opinion is that this worked. I think that there isn't really a way to make the first part of the game more competitive. And I think fans, for the most part, still enjoy seeing the open exhibition style for sure. But the fourth quarter was absolutely more entertaining and I think a big win for the NBA. I think it was a smart move to reformat things. And we'll see if, like, for instance, if the 24 sticks as the target number, it seemed about right. It didn't seem too long. And I don't know that there's any way beyond the charity aspect to make things the first part of the game different. Team LeBron ultimately raised $400,000 for his charity. Team Giannis raises $100,000. And so it all worked out, in my opinion. And clearly both teams, it has more of that playground feel, trying to hit the target score versus playing against the clock. So I think all things considered, that's a win. It was an entertaining All-Star game. I should mention the MVP was Kawhi Leonard as well, as he had 30 points, I believe, in this game. Yeah, he had 30, and he had 25 of his 30 in the first half. Ultimately for the game, he was 8 of 14 beyond the arc, 11 of 18 shooting, 30 points, 7 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 steals, only 1 turnover in this game. LeBron had 6 turnovers, also had 23 points on 20 shots. Anthony Davis had 20 points, 9 rebounds, 9 of 16 shooting. Off the bench, Chris Paul had 23 points, was a plus 13, which was easily the highest mark on Team LeBron. 8 of 13 shooting, 7 of 11 beyond the arc, 6 assists to 2 turnovers for Chris Paul. And then on the other side of things, Team Giannis, most impressive games were Giannis himself had 25 points, 11 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 blocks, which was easily the most on his team. Anthony Davis had 3 blocks on Team LeBron. Kemba Walker had 23 points and 18 shots, 22 and 10 for Joel Embiid, 8 of 13 shooting, 21 points on 10 of 11 shooting with 11 rebounds and just 19 minutes for Rudy Gobert off the bench. Brandon Ingram only played 9 minutes in this game. Interestingly, he only had 2 points, which was a game low for both minutes and points. But overall, Nikola Jokic only had 5 points, but he had a clutch three-pointer late in the game for Team LeBron. So that was fun to see him contribute as well. Overall, just a really fun game. Kawhi Leonard, especially early, really dominated it. It makes a ton of sense that he won the MVP. But I think even players' comments after the game, besides some angst about the game ending on a free throw, I think for the most part, everybody really enjoyed the way that this game finished and the way that both teams competed down the stretch. All right, that's all we have for you today on Tuesday. This week, of course, Wolves don't play again until Saturday, so we'll have a few different topics to discuss throughout the week to keep the conversation going related to the Wolves as we gear up for Saturday's game, home game against the Boston Celtics. We'll bring any additional Wolves news that comes up during the week to you here at Locked On Wolves, so stay tuned for that. That's all we have for you today. Thanks once again for listening to the Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Remember, the Locked On Network is your local experts on the biggest stories. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On T-Wolves. That's at Locked On T-Wolves. Don't forget the T. Once again, I'm Ben Beacon. This is the Locked On Wolves podcast, and we'll catch you next time.